Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet Max Barrett. And, of course, last time we met Max, it was in a TV studio, which was a bit quieter than the coffee shop in Canterbury where we are now. But it's wonderful to meet you for my podcast. And do you want to just say a little bit, Max, about, apart from, I'm sure we'll talk about your favourite films in just a moment, but what is it that you do? Because you work in Canterbury, don't you?
Yes. So primarily my day job, I work with my family business at the minute. It's a sustainability business, so focused on helping design engineers make more sustainable decisions. But weirdly enough, I come from a filmmaking background and a radio background, and there's a lot of translating skills, because whilst my past I was doing broadcast journalism and producing and making films, it's still making digital content, but instead of for more traditional platforms, it's for a digital platform for engineers. So that's my day job.
Yeah, and of course also I know you have a background in film reviews on the road. Was it Radio Kent?
So at BBC Radio Kent, when I was freelancing, I had a mini series on the show with Anna Louise. It was a Sunday afternoon program, and it was a real variety show. And one of the pieces I had was I had a 10-minute film slot every Sunday at 4:10 p.m. for just over a year, I think. And I would choose a selection of movies each week, usually two or three. I'd try and make maybe one film that was a bit more normal and a bit more accessible, and then one or two that were a bit more edgy, off the wall, that the Radio Kent audience may never have heard of. So there was a little bit of something for a general fan, and a little bit of something for if you wanted to go a bit deeper.
And were you then choosing the films based on what was out at the time, or was it random, or were you looking for themes, or was it like films that maybe you'd watched X number of years previously?
Yeah, it was honestly never really stuff that was out in the cinema, because other programs on the station would cover it. So if there was a new James Bond movie out, you know that all week the station's going to be talking about it, because it's relevant and in the news. Whereas for my slot, it was in this period of time, which is, you can be a bit more, I think, free on a Sunday afternoon in radio, because it's a little bit more relaxed, where there's not as much news happening. So I tried to pick movies that were either in a theme, so I would often say what the theme of the next week would be. It might be romance movies, it might be a sort of horror if it's Halloween. So there was sometimes seasonal, sometimes if there was an awareness day I could tie it in with, and then it was often if I'd seen the film, because it wasn't too long after I graduated that I was doing this series, so I was still watching at least four films a week, and I would always be able to dip into that catalogue of films.
Yeah, and were you writing reviews of those? Because I, for me, and maybe it's sort of both an excuse for watching lots of films, but also to ensure that I'm not in that position, which occasionally happens, somebody might say, have you seen so-and-so? And whether you have or you haven't, you can't remember. So I have a good concrete record of what I do, so I can easily dip into that. Actually, it's quite good for radio, because I can just say, I think I saw this on this day in, 7 years ago, and then I can dip in, and then the review will help bring it all back.
Yes, well, I have sort of two ways I would do that. So firstly is, I know it's really simple, but I genuinely just have a Word document, when I see a film, I just add it to it. And I do have a loose ranking, so from 10 to 0, and then I put, if a thing is a 10, it goes as a 10. The nice way of doing that as a list format is, I think I have like nearly 200 films that I've rated 7 out of 10 for multitudes of reasons over the years. And I don't know why I like list formats so much. Until very recently, my entire work and personal calendar were lists, and I've only recently changed that. And so that's how my brain works, and that's how I do it. And also, over on Instagram, I would always post about my film reviews. So I don't know if you've used the story highlights feature, where you can collate a set of your Instagram stories into one, effectively, photo album. And I would just dedicate it to films. So I've got one, I'm at about 85 now in that specific album of sort of weekly film reviews when I was on the station. But then before and after I was doing that segment, I would still always talk about it. So, when I went to the cinema to see the new Alien movie, I'll just post a picture that I'm there and put it in that channel. So when I'm flicking through, I can see what films I've seen, really.
Yeah. Oh, no, it sounds very similar, although far more high-tech than I do, because I put everything on Medium, which is actually a good resource, although it doesn't actually prove to be as interactive as it can be. So I used to put them directly onto Facebook.
Sure.
And then often people would comment. But, of course, if you have to click on a link to get to the review, then people people might think, oh, I'll do it again, or there's always something else whetting one's appetite on social media. But having the radio, of course, is then the real bonus, because in that sense you're able to at least have a platform where you can take your time to plow through a review that you've cultivated.
Yes, absolutely. And my reviews were a mix of pre-recorded and live interviews. And so I've still got all the pre-recorded ones, because I would do that in my home space and then bring them in. Whereas the ones that were done in the studio, some of them I still have and some I don't, based on just the radio archives. But I know that they're always there, so if I need to go and search it out, I'm sure I can find it somewhere. But it is nice having a record of a lot of them and seeing how much I've changed, because the first ones I did, I was so wooden in my delivery. And since then, how more relaxed it became, especially at the end, like the last couple of episodes, when I knew that we were going to be stopping it, all the pressure just relieved and I was just able to be completely myself.
Yeah, and often it's the best way, because then when you can have a conversation about something where it's almost the line between the formal and the informal is blurred, that you're doing a formal thing, but you're doing so in a way that's engaging, that feels very sort of natural in its delivery, can work. And actually you came up in name, because I was looking at what was released on this day in history in a show I do on Cabin FM yesterday, and Hero was released on this day in 2002, I believe. Or was it 2004?
I think it was 2002. Yeah, 2002. Yeah.
And of course, that was a film that you chose. Yes. Of your four favourites there. So you, for me, that was actually really handy, because I couldn't remember if I'd seen it. I didn't used to write reviews in those days, but I do have diaries where I can look back. And there we are. So that gives me a useful time frame in terms of, because that was, I think, the only international martial arts film ever to reach number one in the US charts.
Yeah, and what an incredible milestone. It shows that it actually did break out into an international audience, because I think still there is this thing where if the movie's not in your native language, it can be very tough to bring it across to different audiences. I think the most recent examples that broke that was Squid Game and obviously Parasite as well. Parasite just seemed to break all the rules in terms of who ended up enjoying it, and I think Hero was probably that equivalent, but for the early 2000s.
And so away from film, because anybody listening to this could watch our half an hour chat on KMTV that we recorded just a few weeks ago, which was brilliant. But obviously you're living in Canterbury, but are you from Canterbury originally? Where did the journey start for you, Max?
So I've always lived in Kent, but I was born in Chatham. And I spent the very earliest part of my life in Gillingham, but I grew up in a little village called Lenham. So if you're listening and you know Ashford and Maidstone, it's the little village halfway between, the little medieval market village. Yeah. And it was a lovely place to grow up, because it was a very calm environment. Lenham has something called the Cross, which is a brilliant space to go and walk along the North Downs. And I would do that most weekends. It had access to football pitches, tennis courts, and you know, it was what every village has, you know, libraries, shops. So it was a great place for a kid to be honest. And then when I was 16, moved over to Canterbury, and I've been here ever since. So my life has always been in and around this area. I worked at the dockyard over in Chatham, which brought me back to Medway for a few years. So between Canterbury, Medway, and Lenham, my life has always kind of existed in those three places.
Yeah, no, because in my case, I was in my early 30s before I moved to Kent from South Wales. And it's always funny looking back, because I've still got some family members who live a lot closer together, and yet they hardly see each other. I may see them more than they do each other, because if you're living close to somebody, then it's like, oh, we can see you next week or next month. Whereas, you know, if you're visiting an area, then you're like, well, this is the only week I'm likely to see you. It may not be another year or two before I see you again. So do you have, so I'm guessing that you have lots of family in and around the area?
No, not at all. Interestingly, my family is also from South Wales. So my mum is from Swansea. And so I would spend every summer basically going there a couple times. And admittedly, most of my family from that area have now passed on. They were much older. But when they were still with us, we would go and see them all the time. And so Swansea as a place holds huge, like, emotional feelings to me. And the different places we would go in Swansea, I mean, my great-grandma, who lived until she was 97, she was my last grandparent, was a great-grandparent. And we would always go to the same garden centre in Swansea every time. And so when I think of Swansea, it's memories like that. And even just going to the car boot sale outside the Liberty Stadium, like, I've never even been to see a match in Swansea in the football, but I have been there for car boot sales. Yeah. So my mum's side is there, and my dad's side is in Essex, so over near Clacton on Sea, and we regularly go and visit some of our family that's still over that way. It's got a lovely pier. So I feel like I always do get drawn to the sea because of my dad's side, and then because of my mum's side, it's probably more so that the plants, the gardens, things like that.
Yeah, no, well, I had no idea about the Swansea connection, and it was funny because when I'm presenting a show from Herne Bay, I'm very aware that it's local, and we present local news, and we're aware that the primary audience is local. But of course, inevitably, a lot of people who will listen are people who are listening because they know me, and I may have taught them as I used to live and work in South Wales. And Swansea is actually a place, when I was living in Lampeter, that was the nearest city, so that was the nearest cinema. I think Carmarthen these days does now have a six-screen view cinema, unheard of back in the early 2000s when I was living there. And so I would take a bus down to Swansea every week to what was in those days the UCI cinema. And so the whole Park Tower, which, and very funny, I always try and go back there as often as I can. I don't think I was there this summer, but I certainly was the year before. And so for me, that's where the film journey kind of started, because it became a case of, well, I want to see this film, that film, that film. So how many can I squeeze into one day? It was unusual to squeeze more than two in. I think occasionally maybe three, because I was bound and, you know, demarcated by bus times. But yeah, I had no idea that you had that South Wales connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So no, I'd spent many summers going back and forth to Swansea. I do miss it in a way. It's been a while since I've actually been since sort of losing my great-gran, but I do intend to visit. There was also a small chance that I might still be moving there in the future, because with my work with sustainability and engineering, a lot of work in this area is happening in Wales. I would say that Wales and England are quite similar in terms of how much work is taking place, but in Wales they're doing a much better job at congregating it all, shouting about what companies within Wales are doing, and having directories where you can find it. So there was a chance that I might still move there again, which would be nice. Again, I feel like Wales and even like Medway have been like gravitational pulls to me, you know. It feels like no matter how little time I spend interacting with these places, there's this pull that takes me back to them.
Yeah, and it's like that. Well, what is that program, that famous sort of early 2000s or mid to late 2000s series? It was half set in Essex and half in Barry Island.
Oh, Gavin and Stacey.
And again, that was always hilarious because Barry Island was the closest seaside town when I was growing up in Cardiff. Tell me a bit about sustainability as well, because is that something that you mentioned, of course, it's the family firm, it's something that you're working on here. But when did the interest in sustainability begin?
Yeah, it started at university. So when we were sort of having our modules, there were some really niche modules we got right the way through, which at the time I think many people would have thought, oh, what's the point in these? But since graduating, it all makes sense. And we had a module called Professional Perspectives, and one aspect of it was we had to do sustainability audits of film productions. Now, these were effectively simulations. We weren't taking any big real film productions, but we were going through the process of what it would be like to break down a film production and how environmentally friendly it is and all the parts of it. And that was through something called Albert and an Albert certification. If you watch the BBC, ITV, if you wait to the end credits, you'll always see Albert on all of them now. It's everywhere. And once you start seeing it on TV programs at the end, you'll never miss it on the next one. And so that started the journey. And then my dad is just an ideas man. He always, no matter how many times he makes a new business or a new venture, he's already onto the next one mentally before the last one's even finished. He's very ambitious. And when I was looking to transition back to Canterbury, it was around the same time this sustainability project within engineering was kicking off. And my skill set and his and my mother's, as we work as a three, are completely different. We all have the opposite skill sets that allow us to fill in for each other. So it just made sense to come on board and help out. And it's grown incredibly since then. And my passion for sustainability really kicked off then even greater. And there's one more person I'd like to mention who I saw recently, actually. It's someone called Kieran Paul. He has an initiative called Rubbish Snooker. So I remember telling you before the start of this that I do pool tournaments and things. He's been a part of them. his initiative, Rubbish Snooker, basically combines sustainability, artwork, and snooker. So people send him discarded bottle cap lids that would otherwise just be left on the side of the road. He puts those onto a snooker table in a mosaic style as an art piece, takes a photo of it, and then frames them on sustainable paper, and you can buy that artwork. And he sponsored my first ever pool tournament with some prizes that were those art pieces. And that, up until then, sustainability for me was either how can I tell a story and make sure the film is done sustainably. What Kieran taught me is that sustainability and art can be interwoven. You can do something that has a message that at its core is sustainability. And so it was really my dad, Kieran, and my lecturer Ken, who did that module with Albert at university, those three people who started me on this journey.
Yeah. And I'll come back to your time at university in a minute, but you mentioned about your dad being an ideas man. I can relate to that, because in a way I'm very good at dealing with the, you know, if I had a big batch of essays to mark, in my previous job, that I would do that a lot. I was always very good at getting on with those things at the very micro level. The wider sphere, in terms of, you know, always knowing something I wanted to do, but actually putting it into practice, it was always, you know, the day sort of the particular exigencies, the particular demands of the day, yeah, that would always take precedence over the sort of, you know, the blue skies thinking type approach. Do you follow your dad in that respect?
I'd say I'm similar to him. I love creating new ideas. Once I kind of got settled in with the new job, I was immediately making my pool tournaments on the side. I've done every hobby under the sun you can think of to do with creativity. I've done, you know, photography of Lego, animation. I've hosted tournaments. Strangely, before I went to university, I was hosting murder mystery parties that I was writing myself. I've tried a little bit of it all and had fun along the way, and it's pointed me towards where I've ended up. Even theatre writing, I've had a few bits on there too. So all of these little stints kind of taught me what I love as I've gone on. And weirdly, every single one of them has taught me at least one lesson that I still use now.
Yeah, but there is something about counterpart and counterpoint, which are not opposites at all, because you know, one balances out the other, one complements the other. But there is that notion sometimes, isn't there, where you can be busier than ever. And I found that even with my podcast, that sometimes I've been ridiculously busy in a work context, but if ever one feels one's creativity is zapped, then I'm finding myself recording and editing and putting out more interviews. Now, it makes no sense. You think, oh, I'm too busy at the moment, I can't possibly put them out. But sometimes when I don't have, and very rarely can I say I have not much to do, but then sometimes at those times I'm doing less interviews. And it's funny, as though there's a direct link between being ridiculously busy and being ridiculously creative, as if that's the manner in which I'm best able to hold it all together.
Yeah.
So it sounds like something similar, because if you're doing all those things, it sounds as though if you stop doing one of those, then little pieces of all the others could potentially start to crumble as well.
Yes, I agree. I think momentum is a huge thing, and it took me a long time to work out what the work-life balance of it all was, because when I was at university, I was doing too much. I would have a public speaking evening on, then a theatre evening, and then I'd be hosting a drama society meetup, and then I would be doing an evening shift at the BBC radio, and then so every single night of the week I had something creative on, and in the day I had my classes and my lectures anyway. And not that when COVID hit, that was really the time that changed everything for me. So the COVID pandemic, not that there's ever a good time to have a global pandemic, but it came at the point I personally needed it, because it made me realise just how too much I was doing. Admittedly, as you said, I was being so creative and so much was happening, but I also needed to reevaluate that balance. And now I think really in 2023, I hit the sweet spot of my full-time job having creativity, my part-time muses and side projects having creativity, but also just time to relax and watch a movie, go for a walk, because I think creativity also sometimes just comes from not doing anything to do with work. You can go for a walk along the river in Canterbury, we've got the beautiful River Stour, and I'll just walk along there and I'll think of an idea just by existing in a peaceful space. So it took me a long time to find what my balance is. For some people, they can hold down more work hours than I can, and for some, they need even less than I'm doing. So it's a slightly different metric for everyone. But I think finally I've hit it.
Yeah, and you just reminded me of, I remember going into an exam when I was a student, and I think it was a mature student who was very worried. But she said, oh, something like, I only did 17 hours revision yesterday, I don't feel prepared. Because I was thinking, you did 17 hours. Oh, I might as well, you know, not turn up for the exam then. It's too easy sometimes to see, you know, who is the role model? But also the way that somebody's paradigm may work for them. And actually, you might actually, and one of the great things, of course, part of the nostalgia project, is that sometimes you'll look back and think, well, actually, I don't, you know, that person I may have thought was a role model, but actually the journey that they've taken, and maybe that they then found another path, maybe for them, I was looking up to them at one stage, but then they found a different project entirely to follow. And in that sense, I then had to find another path, my own path, you know, forward. And that happens a lot in education. But tell me a bit about where you did your degree and what your degree was in.
Yes, so I did film production at Canterbury Christchurch University. I loved it. Basically, every module had some kind of practical filmmaking element. It was one of the very few degrees at the time which had almost, well, it had no exams, and the coursework was very minimal. It wasn't zero, we still had to do theory, we still had to write essays, but most of the time was spent making films, and that was brilliant. And so every year and semester we would have a different theme or an objective, and some of them had really good synergy. So in the first half of our second year, we had to do a script writing module, and then the best 10 scripts were taken, and in third year you had to choose one of those and make it. At the end of second year you had to choose one of those and make it. So that was a really nice synergy, because then you could lead from one directly into the other. And that film we made at the end of second year, my film script made it to the top 10, but I didn't want to choose mine, because I really wanted to, as a director, unpack a writer's mind. So I picked a script that I believed was already better than mine, and someone who I was a close friend with. And some of my favourite parts of that was unpacking why he'd written it that way and how to translate that to screen. And that was invaluable. And that's something you can't get unless the writer sat opposite you. And so, yeah, it was a very practical degree, very hands-on. The equipment we got to use was brilliant. And the lecturers, to be honest, they felt like our mates. They were so down-to-earth. It wasn't a big class size. And as a result, if you ever needed someone, they were always there.
Yeah, no, because my experience, in a way, because obviously I'm going back to the early 90s in my case, but I've always been aware that, because I'm always posting something like you do, by the sound of it, in front of a cinema poster, or if I'm going to see a film, you know, I saw Pulp Fiction, actually,
yeah,
which I saw when it came out in 94. It blew me away as much yesterday on the big screen in Dover as it did when I first saw it in 1994.
Wow.
But obviously in those days, I wasn't taking selfies outside movie posters, which I had, my goodness. Think of what a repository I'd have to draw. But if looking back, the thought of any of my lecturers at university doing something like that, even if you saw them in the supermarket shopping, it seemed odd, like they do their own shopping, you know, because there was that sense that they were almost on a different plane. But maybe that was just the way, as an 18-year-old, I saw things. Whether my own students would be remotely bothered or fazed at seeing me going that round different cinemas and doing pictures of that is interesting to me, because, you know, something has changed in 30 odd years. But how interesting in that sense that you're doing this very practical course, that actually the barriers were removed, and there was a sense that this is a real collaboration. It must have been as good for them as it was for you. You were learning from them, but I'm guessing they were learning from you at the same time.
Oh, I completely agree, because the interesting thing about it was that they already had a film, radio, TV degree, but I was the first year they had a dedicated film course, and I believe now the film, radio, TV one doesn't exist. It's only the film course. So I was a crash test dummy for that, and I was at college too, because I was also the first year they'd done a film course at Canterbury College. So really my whole college and uni experience has been a tale of first time tries, which was really cool in a way, because our feedback was the most important as to what had to change for future students. And when I came back and did guest talks in the uni, and I got to speak to the students about how much it's changed, it wasn't a completely different course, but so much had changed to tailor it, and I could feel like it was being tailored off of our experience, which was good to see.
Yeah, although you just made me think as well that although there were some courses that are in the most tangential way similar to what you've outlined, back in the early 90s, if there was anything along the lines of film production, it was VHS.
Yeah.
And it was a very and not necessarily very of a very good quality as well. So in those days, it was literally making a video, and sort of video that wouldn't have worn very well. Was these days, of course, things like Audacity software, which I use for my audio editing. I just learned that myself because there was no capacity to do that. But tell me a bit about the filmmaking side. So when I interviewed you on the film program, your filmmaker status is something as well that I think is very important to you.
Yeah, of course. I think that I've always, my whole life, I've had to be filming something at any one point. And when I was a student in university, well, let's take it back to a bit more in the beginning. So when I was a kid, the thing that really kicked it all off was I made a Lego animation going from year 5, so I'd have been 9 or 10, into year 6, so 10 or 11. And everyone had to do like a summer project about something they loved, and I chose Lego animation. And I made a 2.5 minute video called Back to School, and it was about us coming back to school. And it was a really silly little thing where the other students in my class had faked injuries or faked illness to get out of school, and all the characters do everything they can to leave the school on the first day back. And it got shown hundreds of times, it got shown in front of all the students, it got thousands of views on YouTube, and it was, looking back on it, it is terrible, but I love it. Even though I know objectively it is a very poor movie, as a 10-year-old, I had so much fun making it. It took me 2 months to make from initial conception to final delivered product. But the moment that really made it for me was about 3 years later, when I'm in like year 9 at secondary school. A new year 7 comes up to me on the first day of secondary school and asks if I'm Max who made the Lego animation, because he'd seen it after I'd left the school and had started doing animation because of it. And that was made me realise the power of it initially, that I made a terrible short film when I was 10, and now I'm 13, 14, and it's impacted someone and moved them in some way.
No, and that's the best kind of publicity and self... actually just an endorsement that you can ever get. Because, I mean, sometimes, and this was something that I used to find in higher education, is that we often had to do something that I never felt you would have to do in any other sort of industry, which was to promote yourself. If you wanted to be promoted, you had to say how wonderful you were and find those testimonials. It was almost a case of then almost having to say, I'm brilliant, and here are people who say I'm brilliant. And in a way, there's the part of me, the slightly extrovert side of me, but also a highly modest side of the person who doesn't want to, or imposter syndrome would be. But actually have somebody come up to you and say, it's because of you that I'm doing what I'm doing now, or I'm sufficiently interested or engaged, to have to then come up to you and seek you out and share that with you. That is worth a million endorsements that are somewhat more manufactured.
Absolutely. And that was really the point where I thought, okay, I have to be making some films at some point, because I just want to move people or cause an emotional impact in some way. And maybe that is more so a storytelling thing, because before I went to university, again, I was theatre writing more, and the waves that my playwriting moved people gave me a similar kick. But then when I got to university, as I said, my second year film was that one where I took a friend's script and we put it to the screen and we made it. And that was, we finished making that film a day before the COVID lockdown, and then we edited it in the pandemic, and it went into a festival. So it went into the Rob Knox Film Festival, where I won a personal award, my first and only film award. I won it as a rising star filmmaker, and that was a humongous honour for that. And to even just have our film there was incredible, because all the other films at the festival had some kind of financial backing behind them, and we weren't just the only student film. It was a second year film, it wasn't even my final year. And my final year movie was much more experimental, because it was made in the heart of the pandemic. We couldn't go outside. Everyone involved in the film worked from home. It was a movie about dementia. It's an experience piece movie about dementia, which was inspired by an album called Everywhere at the End of Time, which tries to tell the artistic perspective of experiencing dementia through music. And I tried to do that with film. My grandma passed away from it, and I'd seen some very stark, interesting documentaries on it at the time, and I wanted to do it. So because it was effectively a montage experience, I had audio contributions from genuinely all over Europe. Some of the sound was done in Turkey, Cyprus, Italy, France, Germany, and all of it blurred with visuals that have come from the Netherlands, parts of Kent, and it all just worked. And the key thing I didn't want it to feel like was just a pandemic-only movie. One of those films that you can put down as something you saw that was made in the pandemic, and that's it. And because it's a much more experimental movie, it had a lot more visceral emotions. It made one of my lecturers cry when they watched it in the screening where we were grading it. And that was quite poignant to me, because it is quite an emotional film, a very difficult watch. It's easily the most difficult watch I've made. It's why it's probably not seen any success at festivals yet. I've been sending it around, but hasn't had an appearance at a festival, which I understand, given how off the wall it is. So I think it needs a combination of a bit more editing and also finding the right festival for it. Since graduating university, I have taken that movie and brought it up to speed. I finalised it, because again, when you're making a third-year film, you only get so much time, right, to edit it. And so it became a project that went on in the background beyond it. I only really finished it about 3 years after graduating. So there's always been a film on the go.
Yeah. And that's mightily impressive. How long is the film that you made?
That film is 20 minutes. So it's nothing huge in length. And the second year one was, I believe, only 10 minutes from memory, maybe 12. And so they're short films in their construction. And I've never done anything longer than that. I think an absolute dream ambition of mine would be to make some kind of feature film. But it maybe not necessarily your Hollywood studio kind of style. There's someone that's always inspired me, and not necessarily like my favourite films. I enjoy them, but do you know Jim Jarmusch?
Yes.
So he self-funds his own movies. Yeah. And it doesn't just mean he has full control over them, because I'm not one of those people that has to have control over every bit of it. But I think there's something nice about having no pressure from a studio and you put your money where your mouth is, because I think some people like the idea of making their own movie because of control. I like it just because it removes an external pressure. I still want to make a movie that's collaborative, but he I admire, because he effectively is putting his money where his mouth is every time he makes a movie, at least for his early projects for sure. And so if I was to extend it to feature film and that kind of length, it would be that I would target. Although there's one more funny story I will say, and this is a bit of a silly one, but when I was at university, I did technically make a feature film in the most technical sense of the word. And this is probably one of my favourite films I've made on a personal level that the world's never going to get to see. So me and a few friends in my film and drama classes, what we would do is we made a buddy cop style film. Think like Rush Hour. But we made it where it was effectively an improv movie. Every time we saw each other for nearly 3 years, we would just film a scene every couple of days for 3 years. So on, you know, at some point in first year we started it, and literally the last week of third year we put together the final scene, and it comes out to just under 2 hours. It was all just filmed on my phone and edited on a rickety old laptop. And to me, in a way, that's a very powerful movie, just because it became a diary for uni. All of the memories of all the nights out, of all of the clubs we went to, like the drama clubs and theatre groups, and just fun times, and even some of our lectures and classes, all wrapped into one.
Oh, no, I'm fascinated by that, everything you've said, but particularly that last bit, because one thing that's come up quite a lot in my conversations for this podcast is that when people have their records of what they did at university, there's always a lot of videos or photographs from back in the day that are from the Union Bar, or when people are having a few drinks, when they're a little bit drunk, and you've got a lot of those kind of pictures, or people doing things where they're slightly compromised, like walking the pipe, which was a famous Lambeth thing, walking the river. If you had a few drinks, you'll do that. But never did anyone, and I think the same would apply to my students now, but you never have footage of your lectures or your lecturers.
Yeah.
So you've got plenty of people very drunk. But what about the reason one goes to university, one would like to hope and think, is of course to get a degree. But it's almost as though anything that's filmed inside a lecture theatre is completely taboo. But when you're at a conference, and say an academic conference, it's quite normal to film the person, and even to be posting it live on social media, but not from your own lectures.
Yes. No, we actually have quite a lot, because again, doing a film production degree, when we would try out new cameras and bits and bobs, we would always film it. I've still got a little archive on my computer of photos and video clips from a day when we got a new camera in, and I was filming from my camera the use of the new camera. So it's all these like little clips of us like putting together bits and pieces. So, and that was just in the TV studio space. So I have loads of footage of just very normal things. And again, there were some scenes from that buddy cop film that we made, which took place in classes, where maybe there was a bit of downtime or we were on a break. And for me, I don't drink. So whenever I used to go out on my nights out and I was filming, I was also the guy who was looking after the friends. But it also, you know, and for everyone listening, there was never anything filmed where, you know, they weren't aware of the filming that was happening. It was always very jolly, it was always early in the night, and it was always just at karaoke or when we were just having a drink and a dinner kind of thing. Because that, in a way, loosened up the performances.
Did you know at the time, I mean, obviously, I'm guessing this is not too many years ago, for obvious reasons, because you've indicated that you were at university around the time of the pandemic.
But yeah.
Were you aware at the time that you were doing something that had some sort of longevity or could be useful? Because I wish, because I was at university in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And looking back, I wish I had more, you know, longer diary entries, because I've always kept a diary, but didn't write very much in those days. Certainly, you know, I have photographs, which is great.
Yeah.
We didn't have anything moving in those days. We didn't, you know, nobody had camcorders. And it's easy to want to project back, you know, the technology of today into that era. But obviously, in your case, we're just going back a matter of a few years. But so you were keeping a record while your friends were out maybe having a few drinks, but you were doing something very small. But it sounds as though you may not have been drinking, obviously,
yeah,
but you were doing something that mattered profusely, and you know, you wouldn't have wanted to be anywhere else, because you were effectively documenting what was going on.
Yeah, and the whole film is from my perspective, because I hold the camera in front of me and it doesn't really move. Because the phone I had at the time, the zoom wasn't very good on it. It was one of those iPhones where if you zoomed in a little bit, it already started to degrade the image. So if I was moving, I was moving my whole body with it. So wherever I was where the action was happening. And that's quite nice, because it feels like a POV of my time through uni. And I don't think I really realised it at the time. I think as COVID sort of came to an end, and as my time at uni came to an end, we had a very special night where everybody involved who'd been in the film, even if they were in it for a second, came together around one house and we watched it. And it was obviously dreadful. Like, the film itself, unless you weren't there and a part of it,
I get that,
it's awful. But it was such a nice memory to just sit and watch through that experience again and remember the days out. But I will admit, the first 20 minutes is really tight. I think if I'd made it a 20 minute short, it would have genuinely been a good film. But in terms of legacy for me and my friends, how it ended up, it literally couldn't have gone better.
Well, there we are. So now, whenever I think of point of view movies, I think of Roman Polanski's Chinatown.
Yeah.
But now we have Max Baron. Yeah. So there you are. So Max Baron and Chinatown in the same conversation. So that's worthy. And do you feel, I mean, did you get a lot of, at the time, were your friends aware of what you were doing, or was it only when you sort of screened that they thought, now it all makes sense?
I think that the latter. So they didn't see the editing, because I was only ever editing it, like I said, I was too busy in this time of my life, so I would just edit it on my train journey to the radio station. So we're literally editing for, like, because effectively all I'm also doing is stitching clips, so it's not taking any time. So by the time it was made, everyone sort of realised what had happened, but the main characters were being shown in periodically as nice reminders. I think the people it hit the most were the side characters who had not seen any of it until the final version. For them, it was a wow how big of a difference it was. And some of the people in it had changed so much visually and personality-wise from frame one to the last.
And did they all ask for a copy? Or indeed, did any of their family members ask for a copy? Or they may not have wanted their parents or relations to see?
One of the main guys wants a copy, but I'm very scared he's going to publish the whole thing. So he asks for it every so often. To be fair, I do also forget to give it to him. But one day he will receive a copy of that. But he knows I've always got it. I have it saved in three places. So that movie is not being eliminated anytime soon. And I think when I retire, maybe it can go public at that point. Nothing particularly crazy happens in it, but it's just, it's nice to have as just our thing. But yeah,
time plays a big role in this, because I find this from my diaries, and sometimes it frustrates me, but also sometimes it's quite charming in its sort of oddball sort of way, because there might be entries sometimes. Maybe looking back, I might think, you know, this was a particularly significant time in the light of what happened subsequently, and maybe when you're no longer with those friends.
Yeah.
But at the time, there might be references that the biggest reference might be to some food that I'd eaten at a pub or who I'd been out with, but no more detail. It's the most sketchy sort of material, and it drives me mad. I'm thinking, yeah, but you know, really, it was that the most important thing that happened that day? Was it just a bit random? And but also, it's also a slice of life, as the way my thought processes were at the time. And you mentioned, you know, when you retire, because goodness knows what sort of technology will
yeah.
when that happens. But actually, that will be really significant, because there will be a sense of, wow, that's what people did. People actually went to a physical university, or they did this, they did that. Because, you know, who knows? I mean, for me, I've recently finished working in the university sector, where I've been my entire career. So in that sense, there is something very valuable in a way that we can never predict, because it's that slice of life moment.
And that's why I love watching older movies, even not necessarily crazy old. I recently rewatched Dodgeball, and the amount of out-of-date things in that movie shocked me. Just that you don't even think about. Also references, things that were culturally acceptable to say, brands that you see on screen, like plot points that revolve around people's ability to communicate with each other. Whereas today they'd have a phone. In the movie, there's a character who kind of goes off the grid for a little bit. But, you know, that kind of scene wouldn't necessarily happen in the same way now. You just call them, or you just location find them or something. Now you'd have to create a reason that you couldn't contact them through some sort of signal thing. But then I also love going back and watching really, really old movies and comparing them to today. But particularly how they kind of see the world. So the next film on my watch list to rewatch is Metropolis from the 1920s. Because I only recently found out that movie is set in like 2010 or 2000. And just what people of the 20s imagined we'd be like now. And it's just funny to think of what the sci-fi movies we have that are set 100 years in the future, and how grossly far away we will be. It always fascinates me, our perception of time, and where we will be now and where we were.
Well, no, because I remember writing about, when I was doing my doctorate, I was writing about Blade Runner. Now, so Blade Runner was made, because Ridley Scott's done multiple versions, so made in 82,
yeah,
and set in
2049 is the sequel.
It's the sequel. But certainly when you realise that you're closer to the date in which it's set than actually was made. And at the time it seemed, you know, like, oh, we're heading towards that time.
Yeah.
But again, also that, and Back to the Future, of course, part two, is the hilarious one. Because in a way, you imagine the flying cars. They've overshot. But they also imagine they've still got hard copy newspapers.
Yeah.
And that's the funny bit. Like, they never imagine that the newspapers might go virtual. But the cars in the sky, you know, that was, you know, way too ambitious. Actually, the cars of today are not that different from the cars of the 80s. Well, not in terms of their functionality, obviously.
Yeah.
I think there are technical things with the cars that have changed. But that's another thing as well, isn't it? The way that we see the future. Films like The Matrix, and maybe you were talking about this in your film program, I can't remember. But when you've got a film like The Matrix, which 25 years on, and you see them using hard copy, you know, even like modems and telephones and discs that go into machines. You know, so it was both a technologically very advanced film, but also it's dated more quickly than some of those more character-driven films.
And taking an example from real life, actually, which arguably shocked me even more than the films, was that on the BBC archive there used to be a series, it was a series, I don't know what era exactly, but it was on the BBC archives, and it was called Homes of Tomorrow. And I recently saw a clip of that, and just seeing what in the 80s and 90s someone might think a home looks like in 2020, and the features it should have and what it doesn't have, and how it looks absolutely nothing like a home of today in any way. But then some parts it would get really bright, and you know, every so often when you see those really bright bits, it just stands out like, wow, I'm staring at the future from the past. I'm staring at my now from someone who's guessing.
And it's a perfect moment, as we begin to wrap up,
yeah,
to talk about that whole vantage point of, you know, where you were, and you mentioned your 10-year-old self when you made that video, and where you are now, and where you see yourself in the future. But did you? It sounds as though, even from when you were 10, you may not have known it or articulated it at the time, but it sounds as though you kind of knew or had the skills for the work that you're doing now. Do you think that your younger self would be surprised at what you're doing now?
Yeah, I think that my younger self, in a way, was so crazily ambitious that he would be both surprised of certain things I haven't done yet. He'd be thinking, why aren't you in Hollywood already, Max? Yeah. But then he would also be like, a film award in your early 20s at a real festival, I was not expecting that. So I think he'd be proud, shocked, disappointed, but also immensely, just impressed by the journey more than anything, because the accolades at the end are only worth it if the journey was worth it. The accolade on its own is never enough.
I think that's insane, although it made me think as well, Mad Max would have been a completely spin on that title. Yourself. Yes, exactly. Yeah. If for all the wrong reasons, you made your own Mad Max film.
Yeah.
But there is something important in that, because it's the whole interplay between the journey and the destination. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
Many people want to short circuit the two, and without the journey there, then the accolade means nothing. I mean, if you're someone like Martin Scorsese, he was in his 60s when he won his first and so far only Oscar, that means far more than somebody who gets the Oscar at the age of 9, like Anna Paquin or whatever, who, brilliant performance in The Piano, but she was 9, for goodness sake, So there is that sense sometimes that the journey there and what you've accomplished along the way. I mean, for me personally, Scorsese winning an Oscar, because I am a huge Scorsese fan, but almost when he then won the Oscar, suddenly it was like anticlimactic, because the whole thing was he was the best filmmaker, never won an Oscar, and then he won an Oscar, maybe not for his best film, that's arguable, and then it was like, oh, okay, so suddenly then something is recalibrating. So in a way, the ambition, sustaining the ambition, can be better than suddenly achieving something at the age of 19.
And I agree. I think that's why it's also so important in the film industry to never compare yourself to the person next to you, because film is not a linear path. There are so many careers out there which benefit from being very linear. If you want to become a plumber, there is a set path you take to become a plumber, and that's perfect for that role. It needs consistency, because all plumbing should be high quality and done a similar way to a standard. In the film industry, everything's different. You'll want to be a location designer, then the next day you might want to be a camera assistant. And that's why you can't compare yourself to the person next to you, because otherwise that pressure will make you think you're not successful, when actually, if you look back at it, you've done quite a lot.
Yeah. And also, I suppose sometimes those negative experiences, and I always ask the question in the podcast about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences, but it's really about the way that those knocks, which may be the worst thing at the time, are important for character building. And also, if you really want to do something, you want to achieve it. I mean, imagine if Scorsese's own, I don't know why I'm giving that example, but imagine his own, and it wouldn't be, but his only ambition was to win an Oscar. Well, he might have said, oh, I haven't won an Oscar, we want to do something else. But the whole point is that his passion, it's nothing to do with winning an Oscar.
Absolutely.
And winning the Oscar may be the icing on the cake, but actually it probably isn't the icing on the cake. There are far more important things for him in terms of film heritage and legacy. So it sounds like, in that sense, whether you get the formal accolades or not, you can't not do what you're doing.
And that's exactly why whenever I mention that I've won an award at a film festival, I also like to mention that my third year student film didn't make it to any, because it shows that there's both levels, and that just making the films and having a visceral impact was enough. Having my lecturer cry at the film was the moment I needed, really, to show that this had an emotional impact on someone. The fact it didn't get into a festival does not faze me, because millions of people submit films to festivals and never get them in, and I'm lucky I got even one through. So, yeah, again, comparing it to others, I can only count my blessings that I've got as much as I have done at my age already.
And one final question for you, Max. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
That is a good question to end on. And I would say, do you know what? In the day, when it's bright outside, I look forward. And because I'm in the process of building what's next, when it's dark and it's the evening and I'm winding down, I look back. So based on where the sun is in the sky, we'll answer that question.
Well, no one else has. I've asked that question 200 times, and nobody has answered the question in the way you have. Okay, that's magnificent. No, Matt, it has been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
No worries. Thank you. Really appreciate you having me on the show. And I look forward to hopefully coming on maybe in a little bit in the future and seeing where I am compared to today.